If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Tuesday, January the 7th, and welcome back to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen, the Hoover Institution's Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Fellow in Journalism. Joining me today in studio here on the campus of Stanford University is Dr. Abbas Milani. Abbas Milani is a Hoover Research Fellow and coordinator of the Iran Democracy Project here at the Hoover Institution. He is also the Hamid and Christina Mogadam Director of Iranian Studies at Stanford University. He has written numerous books on Iran, Persia, and his earlier days as a native of that land. Dr. Milani is also the 2017 recipient of the Richard W. Lyman Award given annually to a Stanford faculty member in recognition of his or her outstanding service to the university's alumni. Abbas, welcome back to the podcast. You've been busy lately.
Thank you for having me, yes.
You and I have had conversations in the past about Iran, and it's always a different conversation, and that is not a reflection on you, my friend, but it's a reflection on the nature of the topic that we discuss. Iran is a land that offers lots of questions and very few certainties, even more so after what happened last Friday. And to recap, on last Friday, the United States launched a drone attack that took out the lives of Qasem Soleimani and several other Iranian militia figures at Baghdad's airport. It's raised all sorts of questions that you've been talking about to the media for the past few days. Was it justifiable? Was it legal? Is it an assassination or a strike? Was it thought given to consequences of taking out a high-ranking Iranian official? What does Congress do? Will Congress try to curb the president's military powers moving forward? The Middle East, always a question of the Middle East. Is it going to erupt? Are we going to see something happen in the Strait of Hormuz? Something happen to Israel? Some other nation that has a working relationship with America? And just today, we're talking today on Wednesday. Today's news out of Tehran on Wednesday was that there was a funeral procession, and what a sight it was. Crowds estimated in hundreds of thousands. Apparently some 56 people were crushed to death in a stampede. The funeral was brought to a halt. This reminded me very much of Ayatollah Khomeini's funeral back in 1989, I believe it was, in which he was brought through the procession. The mourners went crazy. I think they literally pulled his body off the truck. They had to airlift his body out of there. I think the Iranian government canceled the actual television feed of the funeral because it was such a frenzy. This raises all sorts of questions. So let's start with the very basic, Abbas. Tell me exactly who was Qasem Soleimani and how he rose. I've heard him described as the second most powerful man in Iran. How does one become the second most powerful man in Iran?
I think it is the right description. He was the second most powerful person. And over the last two or three years, if you followed his site, as I did, for example, he would literally put his own picture on par with Khomeini.
Right, the supreme leader.
The supreme leader. Same size picture, same font, and literally said that the image said that I'm on par. Although he was very humble and he would say I'm just a mere soldier of the supreme leader, but he clearly considered himself as more than that. He was a commander of the Quds Brigade. The Quds Brigade is part of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, IRGC. And it is the arm that is responsible for regime's proxy wars in the region.
Right.
But in reality, I think he was both the commander of that unit, but as the role of that unit, as its budget, as the number of its proxies grew, as some of his ex-commanders became Iran's ambassadors to Iraq, Lebanon, Syria, almost all of them were his minions. His influence grew, and he became the second most powerful person in Iran. And although the IRGC is profoundly despised in Iran as essentially the tool of suppression, because most of his activity was outside Iran, and some of his activity during the war with Iraq was fighting Saddam Hussein, and some of his activity in Iraq later was fighting ISIS,
right,
that gave him a special place, and going after him thus was really, after going after Khamenei himself, I think the most serious step the United States could take.
Would the parallel be the likes of maybe Moshe Dayan?
Oh, I think absolutely.
Who was a military leader before he becomes the head of the state.
Yeah, and who had, after his pictures came out, became very iconic.
Right.
One of the other things that I think you have to remember is that the regime very carefully calculated and created an image for him. Calculated and cultivated.
Okay.
Because they were clearly trying to place him as a potential person who could save the regime if it went into crisis. So there was this PR campaign for him, kissing babies, crying in morning sessions, reading poetry, talking about him as this patriot. So with that background, the image of him that the regime had tried to create had found some resonance in the people, and that's why there was such a remarkable outpouring of mourners.
Right. I want you to assign the proper noun with this word before it, terrorism. Terrorism mastermind, terrorism architect, terrorism enabler. How would you describe him?
I think all of those.
All of them.
Because he was the main person in training Hezbollah in Lebanon. He was clearly the main person in training and arming and radicalizing the Hashd al-Sha'bi in Iraq, the Kataab al-Hezbollah in Iraq. And you could absolutely say that he had a very important role in creating this very important network. But he was more than that. I think he was also, as I said, a de facto foreign minister for the Middle East. A famous story about General Petraeus, when he lands there, he receives a message through, I think, Iraq's president, who said, Soleimani said, if you want to do business around here, forget about the Iran's embassy, forget about everybody else, I'm the boss here.
I've seen that Soleimani's travels also took him to Russia.
Soleimani...
what would he be doing in Russia?
He went to Russia, by all accounts. We don't have clear evidence of what he was doing. But every indication is that he went to Russia and met with Putin and coordinated a joint Iran-Russia effort to save Assad.
Right.
There were moments where I think everyone thought that Assad was a goner. And I think, to no small measure, Soleimani was very influential in both bringing forces from the IRGC and then also bringing forces from Afghanistan. He and the person that was his deputy, who has now been promoted to replace him, these were the people who brought in several tens of thousands of Afghan Shiites, gave them some money, gave them a promise of a permanent residency in Iran, and sent them to fight for Assad. Just yesterday, I saw a tape of an interview or of a talk by an Afghan lady who was a member of a parliament, Ms. Qajar, and said, Qasem Soleimani is responsible for the death of 5,500 Afghan Shiites that were sent to Syria to fight. So the problem with the discussion in this country, and even the discussion among some of the Iranian diaspora, is that they try to reduce it to one word. Mm-hmm. And then they're either for that word or against that word. He's a more complicated figure.
The diaspora would certainly include Los Angeles, which has a large, very large Iranian community.
Los Angeles, here, Toronto, London, there are, I think, a minority, but a very militant minority who rejoice at his death. There are others who think that this was a wrong decision to take. This is, after all, an Iranian official, and to have been killed like this in Iraq is wrong. And there are those like me who say, I think it was a wrong decision politically to go after him that way. But it's also a wrong decision for the U.S. and for Iranian Democrats, because taking him out was the best gift the Iranian regime could have received in the last few weeks, when it was facing absolute serious strategic structural challenges.
Right, you're leading to my next question, which was, let's discuss the state of Iran on January the 2nd, which is the day before Soleimani is killed. Two things going on there. There is uncertainty as to the future of the country, where it's going on, let's say, the nuclear deal. Is it going to break the deal, or are they, the Trump administration, going to find common ground? But the other thing, Abbas, is the Iranian government's looking at a parliamentary election coming up on February the 21st. And if you read the coverage of Iran in December, there's a constant narrative, which is that this government is looking for a way to get a grip on the people before the election comes up in February, lest it be embarrassed.
I think it's a very good look back. If you look at before January 2nd, go back 45 days. 45 days before that, hundreds of thousands of Iranians came into the streets. The regime went after them with absolute brutality, killed, by some accounts, up to 1,000 of them. Mm-hmm. Some have put the figure at 1,500. They arrested about 7,000 to 10,000 people. So domestically, they were under siege. Regionally, they were also under siege. In Iraq, people paid very little attention to what was going on in Iraq in that period that we're talking about. Ayatollah Sistani, the highest Shiite authority in Iraq, had issued statements that were clearly aimed at Iran, basically telling Iran and Soleimani, because he was the enforcer,
right,
to stay out of Iraqi politics.
Right.
In Shiite cities, Iranian diplomatic posts were attacked and burned. Sunnis were very angry. All of that narrative suddenly changed.
Right.
The parliament of Iraq, albeit all the Shiites are the only ones who voted for it, but they have enough majority that it became a non-binding parliament resolution demanding not that Iran stay out of Iraq, demanding the exit of U.S. forces.
You mentioned the protest and the Iranian government cracking down on the protest. Would that be Soleimani directing the crackdown?
Soleimani did not direct the crackdown, but there are allegations, and more than allegations, there's a lot of evidence that some of his troops, mm-hmm, as well as maybe some of the Iraqi allies of his troops, were brought in to suppress a major sort of center of uprising in the city of Mashhad.
Right.
In the city of Mashhad, they went and really used heavy machinery against the heavy machine guns against people, and his troops are said to have been involved in that.
So this is the contradiction I'm trying to understand. I want you to help me with this. You see the visual of the funeral procession, and you see this massive outpouring of grief and the portrayal of this dead man as a martyr. And yet, at the same time, he is involved in repressive activities in his own country. So explain to me how the average Iranian balances these two. Somebody who has been a very exalted figure in their country, but also somebody who's been involved in a lot of bad things within the country.
Well, as I said, the regime had a very clear, calculated policy of trying to separate him from that oppression apparatus. They had absolutely put in place a plan to make it seem like he is different than the other IRGC commanders. Another thing that I think helped his image was that there were very few allegations of corruption against him. Every other commander of the IRGC is embarrassingly corrupt. The allegations against Soleimani were very few. There are only two or three I have ever heard, and those are allegations. One of them, of course, came from Ahmadinejad.
Right.
So they had created this image of this someone who's a little different than the rest of this bunch. And they had also helped create this image that here is someone who is protecting fatherland, motherland. Is fighting ISIS. The image, you have to understand, the image that was created in Iranian media was that ISIS was essentially defeated by Qasem Soleimani.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's true, but that's what Iranians were being fed.
Right.
And have no mistake, ISIS absolutely hates Iranians. It doesn't think Iranians are Muslims. They think they're worse than infidels. If you read ISIS literature, And I've read what they wrote about a lot of things. The radical Sunnis, like ISIS, don't accept Iranian Shiites as Muslims. One of their major plans in ISIS was to essentially take over Iran and create a new Islamic state out of it. And the regime sold it to the Iranian people that the only reason that ISIS isn't knocking on your door and taking your woman as slaves is Qasem Soleimani. So in that context, it isn't, to me, very surprising. And then also, if you go back to the last 3 days, the regime had a remarkable 24 hours, 3 days, propaganda blitzkrieg in favor of it. They shut down the country literally. 3 days of national mourning, all offices closed. Radio and television were blasting full time. And they were blasting, again, very interesting to note how the regime operates.
Right.
They weren't just blasting Shiite mourning rituals. They were doing that. But they were also playing nationalistic, secular Iranian music. There is a famous Iranian song called O Iran, A Iran. It was the first song broadcast on Iranian television when the revolutionaries took over the radio and television in 1979. It is the de facto national anthem of non-religious, secular Iranians.
It's basically the Iranian Marseillaise.
Exactly. That would be like Marseillaise. In every Iranian meeting, if you read that, you have the Casablanca scene repeated. Everybody gets up. Everybody has tears in their eyes.
Right.
The regime banned it after they took over the Islamists, banned it essentially from television. They used it once when Iraq attacked Iran. They used it for a few days because they needed to rile up nationalists. And they've been playing it in Iranian television in the last 3 days. They've been playing music that they had banned for the last 4 or 5 years because they wanted everybody out. And if Soleimani didn't have that special cachet, all of this wouldn't have worked.
Right.
Because of that cachet, and because they went all out, it worked. And there's one other thing that I think needs to be understood in this context and might determine the mistakes that the regime might make, the Iranian regime might make in the next few days. And that is Qasem Soleimani had a very special relationship with Khamenei, the supreme leader. If you look back at their pictures, Khamenei has given him the highest military medal in Iran.
And he's kissing him on the forehead and he's crying.
Absolutely. And the way he was crying for this, many people say this was all hypocrisy. I have seen his hypocritical weeping. Mm-hmm. He's very good at it. But this one to me was a little more because I'd seen exactly those pictures you're referring to.
But Abbas, couldn't you also argue that the Ayatollah has also now put himself in a corner where he's boxed himself in? He has to do something to respond. This to me is the equivalent of George Bush, the second George Bush, Bush 43, in 2001, not responding to 9/11. If the regime is going to play this up to this level, that this is such a direct insult to the Iranian people, such an injustice done upon us, he has to do something against the United States.
Absolutely. I think he has put himself in a position, and the rhetoric that has come out of Iran in the last 24 hours, the Iranian parliament just declared the Defense Department a terrorist organization. Iranians, military leaders have said, we have all the 28, 27 U.S. bases in the region on our missile sites, and we are going to bring fire and fury. That kind of a rhetoric, I think, absolutely plays into the hands of those who say the only way to get rid of this regime is to go to war with it.
It does, but if you look at the history, the timeline of Iranian reactions, reprisals, they don't react immediately.
No.
Right. So do you think this is different? Do you think there's a possibility of something? I don't want to put you in these speculative positions. You didn't bring a crystal ball into the studio. But they do have this February 21st deadline of election coming up. Do they have to act between now and February the 21st, or can he let this simmer for a while?
Well, I think they can let it simmer. Mm-hmm. When Rouhani said we have a year and a half to let it simmer, the conservatives went after him with absolute vengeance.
Right.
I mean, the level of vitriol from Khamenei's supporters. There's a paper in Iran called Kayhan. An editor is directly appointed by Khamenei. It's one of Khamenei's. It is actually the favorite journalist by Khamenei. Mm-hmm. Vicious, absolute amoral character. And I have to say, he has attacked Stanford, he has attacked Hoover, he has attacked me, Mike McFaul, and Larry Diamond repeatedly. So by way of disclosure, I should say this.
Well, that's good company to be.
Oh, absolutely. Way. I mean, to be attacked by Kayhan is a badge of honor.
Right.
But you look at the paper this morning and says we should execute anybody who has ever suggested that we should negotiate with the United States. We should execute anybody who says we should not immediately take out military sites. So the regime doesn't really have the temperament.
Right.
The conservatives don't have the temperament, the wisdom to use this moment. They could have. If they were prudent, they would have. You have the outpouring of support. Bask on it. Bank on it. And try to solve some of your problems, including the election that is coming up. But no, they don't, because the nature is thuggery.
Let me throw another timeline at you, and it's not the February parliamentary election in Iran, it's the November election in the United States. And this question, in responding to the United States striking back, if you're the Iranian government, are you trying to strike back at the United States in general in this case, or now Donald Trump in particular, because it is Donald Trump's decision to target Soleimani?
Well, you know, I think, again, part of what their strategy had been till now, mm-hmm. before this attack, was to try to wait out and see whether Donald Trump gets reelected.
Right.
Because the pressures on the economy is so radical that they needed to do something. But now, I think anybody would tell them that getting into a fistfight with Donald Trump is going to help him get reelected. So
right.
It puts them in a very difficult double bind, I think.
Right. Let's talk now about the Iranian people, the Iranian man on the street, the Iranian woman on the street. Your Twitter feed has a lot of Farsi on it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know who's talking to you on Twitter. I don't know if I'm in Iran, if I can get to Twitter or not, if it's been blocked or not. I don't know if I would have the gumption, the courage to actually post something critical of the government. I read stories where, especially British media stories, where they talk to people in the streets in Tehran, and they're just livid about what happened, and they hate the United States, but I kind of wonder if I felt otherwise, would I dare raise my head and say this, knowing I live in a repressive regime? Are you getting any kind of feedback within Iran that this was a good thing to do?
Well, yes. I think in Twitter, if you follow the Twitter,
mm-hmm.
And I do have a Twitter account, and I have close to 60,000 people, many of them inside Iran. I know from the responses and the kinds of information that they have. And from when they shut down internet, when those demonstrations began, the regime shut down 95% of access to internet in Iran. When there was hints of new demonstrations a few weeks ago, 2 weeks ago, they again shut it down. And I know from how many responses I get to my Twitter messages that there's a lot of people inside Iran. There are people who say this was a good thing. There are people in Iran who say the only way you're going to get at this regime is if you hit it.
Right.
And nothing else is going to help us. There are people who are angry and frustrated and think a war, essentially.
Right. The other
but I don't believe that. I mean, I just have to say that.
The other thing that strikes me, Abbas, is if I'm Ayatollah Khomeini right now, I'm probably confused. I'm confused in this regard. I looked at Donald Trump a few months ago, if I'm the Ayatollah, and I saw Trump not willing to use force against Iran after the drone attack. Famously backed off it. Mm-hmm. Now I look at Trump, and he has gone 180 degrees in the opposite direction. He took a menu of options against Iran, and he took the most drastic measure, which was mm-hmm. taking out that general. So I'm now kind of wondering, all leaders, all countries have intelligence that do, you know, surveys, do you know, profiles on leaders. I'm now probably calculating, what does this guy think? In other words, Donald Trump to me is now a wild card. I don't know what he's going to do next. I don't know what he would do if I did something to him. And maybe that's a good thing to have him confused.
I think that's absolutely true. Mm-hmm. If you look at the way they went about their business, the Iranian regime, in the first few months of Donald Trump, they were very cautious because they weren't sure what he's going to do. They thought that he is radical enough that he might absolutely go at them.
Right.
Gradually, as they tested, they concluded that because he has been saying he doesn't want a war in the Middle East, they can push him around and he won't respond.
Right.
I think they absolutely underestimated his resolve to eventually. They went after Saudi Arabia. The U.S. did nothing. Many other things. And in this sense, when they went after the embassy, when they had their forces attack U.S. Contractors, I think they thought it's more of the same.
Right. Do you think the average person in Iran, though, the average person in Iran who might be sympathetic toward what Trump did, do they understand the nuance here? Because the nuance to me, a lot of people think that this strike came after, it came in response to the terrorist act that killed the contractor and wounded some soldiers. But I think actually that gets a timeline wrong. Between that and the murder of Soleimani was actually the storming of the embassy in Baghdad and nearly creating another hostage crisis.
Yeah. And unfortunately, again, that very same paper that I referred to, Kahan, literally on, I think, 5th of October, wrote a very long essay as Baghdad was reeling from demonstrations, that the only way you're going to solve this, because their theory was that the demonstrations in Iraq are the work of Saudi Arabia and the United States and Israel. And Kahan said, the way you're going to solve this is the way we solve our problem, take over the American embassy. So there was a direct link to what people did in Iraq to the Iranian, aside from the fact that, you know, Hashd al-Shaabi and Kataib are creations of Iran, and Iran has profound influence in them. And I think they miscalculated. They thought they can attack the embassy and get inside of it, and Trump won't do anything. I think they forgot that Pompeo made his name talking about Benghazi. That Trump made part of his political posture saying that the Democrats were irresolute. So somebody didn't tell them, don't go after the embassy.
Somebody did not get the memo.
Somebody didn't get the memo, I think.
Let me ask you the big question. I don't want you to predict the next move from the regime, but let's talk about what happens next within the population. Do you see the prospect of any kind of uprising in 2020? Do you think the parliamentary election is going to result in some way for a greater yearning of democracy, or are we just on this course with Iran for the foreseeable future?
You know, as you indicated in your opening comments, what happened in Kerman today, for example, the fact that now it's upward of 70 people killed, upward of 200 injured, this is absolute pure mismanagement.
Right.
This regime knows how to control the crowd.
Right.
And the fact that I was on a Persian BBC, and just before they talked to me, they had a program from Kerman, from the street. And you could see that they had these cement blocks in the middle of the street. They hadn't even bothered to move the darn blocks.
Right.
So that, and even more importantly, I think, what caused the demonstrations 50 days ago, our economic needs and economic crisis.
Right.
Those, I think, are going to be increasing. The problems are going to be increasing. I would be very surprised if those demonstrations don't return.
Right. So these are the forces I'd like to get away from me inside of Iran. There's short-term anger, ginned up by the regime, and there's long-term misery.
And the regime, if it was less ideological, more pragmatic, quote-unquote, would have recognized that this is a moment that they can use this public mourning, this public outpouring of support to try to get some kind of a national unity. Not unity. You can't create unity if you continue the status quo. Create the unity by saying, we've made mistakes. Now you have essentially forgiven us, maybe. We're going to correct our ways. But they don't have it in their DNA.
Right.
And every indication in the last 24 hours is that they're going to use these demonstrations not to open up the space for a dialogue, but to shut down any dialogue that had existed.
You get a call from the White House. It's the president on line one, and he wants to ask you, Abbas, how do I get to the Iranian people? How do I communicate with them? What's your advice?
Well, I would say, first of all, don't threaten to destroy cultural sites.
That was my next issue, the word culture. Let's get to that moment, but just how do I communicate with the people? I know there are filters, but what gesture, what means, how does he actually get to a population?
I think you get to the population by saying that we support your yearning for democracy.
Right.
And you don't do this just by talking. You have to have actions. Mm-hmm. You can't sanction medicine, as the U.S. has not done, and expect the Iranian people not to be angry. You can't ban the Iranian people from coming into the United States and expect that the regime won't use this ban to tell the people, no, no, don't believe Donald Trump. They don't want you. In the last 24 hours, there have been Iranian-American citizens trying to enter the United States, and there are some indications that they were bothered at the border.
Right.
The regime is using these things. I would tell the president, end all of these things. Show the Iranian people that these sanctions are against the regime. They're not against you. You are welcome in this country. The children of the people who are killing you and the people who are killing you, we are not going to let come into this country. But you who are fighting this regime, you Iranian dissidents who are fighting this regime, we welcome you. Come here. We used to bring 8-10 Iranian intellectuals, writers, dissidents from Iran, come here to Hoover, to Stanford, give a talk, go back. Mm-hmm. That is a good thing for democracy, a good thing for the United States. That's how the United States partially succeeded in defeating Soviet Union.
Right.
That's okay. What I would tell him.
So you're giving me a presidential deed, which is alter the sanctions. But now let's talk about presidential words and rhetoric. And you mentioned the magical word. It's the word cultural, which ended up in a presidential tweet, which the administration has to quickly walk back. What would possess Donald Trump to use this word culture? Because, Abbas, when I hear that word, my first thought goes to ISIS. And this is what ISIS has done in Iraq. It's teared down cultural relics. So what would possess the president? How could that word pop up in his Twitter feed? Is this just Trump being a bull in a china shop?
I think that's what it is. And when Pompeo tried to help him and say that's not really what he meant, he initially doubled down and said, no, that's what I meant. How can they go after our people and we can't go after their sites? Well, and then you had people on Fox News suggesting literally sites that they should hit. That is what ISIS does. That's what Taliban does. The United States is different, should be different. And then the Secretary of Defense, to his credit, came out and said, even if we are ordered, we're not going to do this. This is against the law. And then the president walked it back. He said, I didn't know it was against the law. If it's against the law, we're not going to do it. But the damage is done. The Iranian media has taken that and run with it. And the later denial, is not going to be as effective. And the narrative is already that this was so egregious, everybody attacked them so much, they had no choice but to take it back. So I can't, for the life of me, believe that the president of the United States doesn't know that going after cultural sites is against UNESCO. U.S. has signed two treaties.
Right. It's literally a war crime to go after cultural.
It is a war crime.
Right. Is there a role for a third country to play in this scenario? France, for example. Germany.
I think there is a role for all the countries, I think. Mm-hmm. France, Japan. The two countries that we haven't talked about and can potentially have the most benefit from all of this and a big role are Russia and China.
Russia and China, which are now developing a naval presence inside the Persian Gulf, right?
The first time in history that Russia has a naval presence in the Persian Gulf. They're about to long-term lease, a naval base in Bushehr. China is reported to be negotiating for a similar lease for another base. Mm-hmm. That is a game changer. If everybody who talks about a coming Cold War is right, if there is already a Cold War, if there is coming a Cold War between China, Russia, and the United States, what happens in the Middle East is not insignificant. But the rest of these countries I don't trust Russia to try to interfere in a way that is beneficial to Iran or the United States.
Right.
But I think Japan, I think Europeans, I think Turkey and India, they have an interest in not having this war happen. And I think they should all use their good offices.
Their interest would be economic, the Strait of Hormuz, right?
The Chinese and their...
No, you mentioned the Japanese and the Indians.
Absolutely.
And, traffic.
And their interest would be both the Strait of Hormuz, but also a potential war with Iran has other consequences. You might have an outpouring of hundreds of thousands of people fleeing this war. Where are they going to go? They're going to go to Europe. They're going to go to Turkey. You're going to have a changed dynamic. Israel, I think, I know Mr. Netanyahu supported it, but I wrote a piece for Project Syndicate, and the other person that wrote it, another piece on the same topic, was Israel's ex-foreign minister. And he thinks that Israel has to worry about a flare-up of a confrontation, because if Iran is hit heavily, I would be extremely surprised if Iran doesn't use all of its proxies in Syria and Lebanon.
Well, Israel reportedly was ready to kill Soleimani back in 2015. And if the reports are correct, the Obama administration actually warned Iran that this was going to happen to deter it. Why would Israel do that to Iran?
Well, Netanyahu just initially supported it.
Right.
And then later, Netanyahu distanced and said this wasn't Israel, although there are reports in both Israel and in the regional media that Israel might have provided some intelligence.
Right.
But he said, absolutely not. We had nothing to do with it. We don't want anything to do with it. Because he understands that if this ends up in a war, Israel is not going to remain unhurt.
And the Bush administration reportedly also considered doing this.
I think they did consider doing it, and they moved away from it because they thought the cost far outweighs the benefit. He wasn't like a bin Laden who was hiding in a room and not coming out for years. This is a guy who was moving around the Middle East, taking selfies of himself often. I don't think it was impossible to get to him. And there is occasion, there is also reporting, very good reporting, that at one time the United States clearly had him in a house. They had the house surrounded in Kurdish region of Iraq, and they decided not to take him.
Right. This does go, Abbas, again, it brings up the question of what it would make me think as a doubtful Iranian leader, because what I've seen now is the second most powerful man in my country lands at an airport. Somebody, the United States, Israel, somebody has the ability to know exactly where he is and also has the means to kill him. So again, this would make me kind of wonder, what can they do to me?
Yeah, I think that has to come to their mind. I think they have to be concerned. But I think, again, if you go back, he wasn't like a Baghdadi or a bin Laden who was hiding. He was traveling. Part of this journey, part of this travel, from what I have seen.
He was coming from Syria, wasn't he?
From Syria,
right.
Was on a commercial flight. So the idea that someone with this kind of a recognizable image can get on a commercial flight and somebody wouldn't tell the Israelis or the Americans or the French, to me seems remarkable. I mean, the way they went about this and how open he was seems to me to indicate that they thought everybody knows what would happen if they go after.
Right. But also, it also suggests a cockiness on their part that we just don't think they have the nerve to do this.
Yeah.
Just don't have the,
And again, part of when you read the Iranian regime media praise for him, part of the way they praised him was that here was this brave man who went to the front and everybody was after him, but bullets won't touch him. Bullets couldn't touch him.
Right. Okay, so again, let's put this in the time frame. There was an election in Iran on February the 21st. So today is January the 7th, so we're talking about 6 weeks. That election, though, ends on February the 21st, and we're now back to the sad state of life within Iran. How does this regime continue to beat the drum, fan the flames, continue to keep the public, for lack of a better word, distracted by this event when there are terrible conditions at home? How long can you maintain that from a propaganda standpoint?
I don't think you can maintain it with the propaganda.
Well, it speaks to them having to do something.
Right. The one thing that all dictators have recognized, from Lenin to Stalin to everybody, is that you can bully people into submission in every domain. The economy has its own laws. If you're not capable of solving the economic problems, you have a deep, serious problem. And the regime is absolutely incapable, in my view, of solving that problem. No amount of propaganda is going to solve it. Again, if they had the slightest wisdom and flexibility, they might have used this. They might have used this moment and say, look, we're in a crisis. We're in a state of war. We need to bring everybody into this discussion. They can't even accept the reformists who have been supporting this regime, who are advocating anything they can to find a way to support this regime. Today's Kahan, who speaks for Khamenei, he said, we're going to execute you. How are you going to solve the economic problem? 50% inflation minimum, 30% unemployment, 70% unemployment on college-educated women, massive exit of capital, absolute shortage of sale of oil as your major source of revenue.
Right.
I think the parliamentary election is, I would be very surprised if it garners too much attention, because they're not going to let too many people other than themselves run.
There are 16,000 people running, I believe, and there are, 291. What does one do in the Iranian parliament?
Virtually nothing.
You do what you're told to do, right?
You do what you're told. And, again, there are indications of a parliament, for example, deciding to do something that seemed to have some reasonable angle to it, and Khamenei issues an order, literally, and they withdraw the proposal. There was, after they went after the demonstrations and killed several hundred people, one person in the parliament said, we have a resolution we are going to pass, we're going to suggest to impeach the Ministry of Interior for responsibility. And they began to collect signatures. I think they had 30 odd signatures. And then they said, we have decided to announce that we haven't actually received such a request because Mr. Khamenei has said, don't do it. And that isn't a parliament. It's not even a parliament that stamps everything the leader says. It has become an empty shell of a
16,000 people running for office. What are the odds of one man or one woman coming forward and saying, enough is enough in this country? Things must end.
One person, again, there's a concrete example. One person 2 days ago said, it is now time to de-escalate the rhetoric. It's now time to talk to the United States. He was a member of a parliament, supposed to have diplomatic immunity. Not diplomatic immunity, parliamentary immunity. They went after him with such vehemence. Every media outlet, television, they attacked his base in the city of Tabriz. He came out and apologized. He said, I'm sorry, I made a mistake. So good indication. The gentleman that was initiating the call to impeach the Minister of Interior, 2 days ago, he was one of the critics of this regime, the reformist critics, quote unquote, but the most active, Mr. Sadeghi. He just introduced a bill yesterday demanding that Iran exit NPT, Non-Proliferation Treaty. In other words, he is now trying to out-radicalize the regime, who hasn't ever said so far that we're exiting NPT. That's what all of this has done.
Interesting. Not to wish anybody dead, not to wish something bad to have someone, but if you're looking for a way to and somehow trigger a response to this regime, don't you need to create in some way a martyr, someone who has the courage to come forward, someone who pays for that, pays a price? In other words, Khomeini was a martyr. Khomeini being exiled, he uses a martyr to spark a revolution. Doesn't internally the Iranian, those citizens willing to uprise, don't they need a figure to rally behind?
Well, they've tried to create out of, literally out of Soleimani, a martyr. Mm-hmm. But instead of creating a martyr that would allow them to do the things they might need to do to survive, they've gone back to their DNA, which is the way you stay is oppression. The way you stay is absolutely eliminating on all opposition. So they're using that martyr, not as an icon of national unity, but as an icon of religious dogmatism. It's interesting, in the last 3 days, they kept talking about Soleimani as a national soldier, a soldier of the country.
Right.
Now, the minute all of this has ended, they're now talking about the soldier of Khamenei, Khamenei's obedient soldier. That change tells me where they're going.
Final question, Abbas. You've been doing a tremendous amount of media the past few days about what happened, about what's going to happen. As you deal with different media institutions, different nations' media, tell me which nations kind of get this right, what gets you wrong, what you've been, if you've been surprised by any line of questions, if you feel some part of the story is going unreported or undiscussed.
No, I think everybody, in my view, everybody is equally in a state of anxious confusion. I was talking to the BBC, for example, which, you know, Persian BBC is probably one of the most credible. And they were worried about this. I mean, the reporting that, as I told you, just before I came here, I was doing an interview with them. And the report that was setting up the interview absolutely indicated how confused, surprised they were at the regime's incapable management of what they knew would be a massive show of support in Soleimani's hometown. So I think everybody is trying to figure it out. And I think everybody is really worried that it, this kind of a rhetorical increase that we see on both sides. In the U.S., again, Pompeo was trying to say we're de-escalating. Esper was saying we don't want a war. But then a couple of tweets that the president had increased the rhetoric again. Khamenei's rhetoric has been from the beginning absolutely unambiguously dangerous, I think.
Final question. You wrote a terrific column just very quickly assessing what post-Soleimani Iran looks like. What is your next column?
I have written a longer piece with Mike McFaul. Mm-hmm. Hopefully it will come out in the next few hours, where we try to put this moment in a historical context and suggest what might be a way out of it. And the way out of it, I think, is de-escalate the rhetoric and on both sides and allow time to heal a little bit. Otherwise, I think the war, that if it happens, and I hope it doesn't, I think it will engulf all too many people, and it will, I think, be detrimental to the people of Iran who are innocent, essentially captives to this regime.
And my final question, I promise, this is the final question. Your sense as to the chances of the two sides being able to talk to each other, war, something in between?
Well, unfortunately or ironically, my sense is that in spite of his occasional rhetorical tweet storms, President Trump doesn't want to get into a war in the Middle East.
He campaigned expressly on that in 2016.
It's been the consistent element of his foreign policy for 20, 30 years, I think. And Iran, in spite of its bombast, can't really afford it. I think they know as well as I do, I think far better than I do, because they have data that I don't have access to, how fraught their situation is. So that, to me, gives some hope that because of his longstanding opposition to war and because of their economic weakness, we won't get into a full war, I hope.
We'll see what happens. Abbas Milani, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, sir.
You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States, in this case, American policy toward the people and government of Iran. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us. And if you wouldn't mind, please spread the word. Get your friends to have a listen. The Hoover Institution is online at www.hoover.org. And while you're there, do yourself a favor and sign up for the Hoover Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Abbas Milani and his Hoover colleagues to your inbox weekdays. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is at Hoover Inst. That's at Hoover INST. Abbas Milani is on Twitter. His Twitter handle is his name backwards. It's Milani Abbas, and I'll spell that for you. MilaniAbbas, at Milani Abbas. You'll also find an interesting page on the Stanford website dedicated expressly to his research and writing. For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Until then, take care. As always, thanks for listening.
For more podcasts from the Hoover Institution, please visit hoover.org or Hoover's channels on iTunes, iTunes U, Stitcher, and SoundCloud. I'm Chris Dauer for the Hoover Institution. Thanks for listening.